Welcome to The Latest on the Law, a podcast of the Boston Bar Association. The Commonwealth's premier legal association, the BBA is home to over 15,000 members and 140 institutional partners consisting of law firms, corporations, government agencies, legal aid organizations, and law schools. Visit us at bostonbar.org to learn more.
Hi, everyone. I'll start off by first introducing our speakers today. First, we have Katie Santolo. She is a partner at Keiko, Weissman & Colasanti, where she concentrates her practice on all areas of family law, including divorce and custody, child support modification, alimony, paternity matters. Since 2013, Katie has also been actively involved in the Attorneys Represented Children's Program, which provides pro bono representation to children in high conflict domestic relations proceedings. Elisa Brill is a senior attorney at Callahan and Baracco, where she also concentrates her practice on all aspects of family law, including divorce, paternity, child custody, alimony, modification matters, and contempt matters. She also represents people in guardianships of minors cases, guardianships of incapacitated persons, and grandparents' rights visitation matters. Attorney Brill has both experience in legal service aspects as well as private practice. My name is Jennifer Silva. I'm a senior attorney at Mavridis Law. Much like the other speakers, I practice family law. And in between the three of us, I think we pretty much practice in most courts in the state. So we have a very good kind of array of how judges in Massachusetts deal with pretrials and, you know, the work you have to put in prior to pretrial, because what we want to emphasize is it's not just a one-day hearing. You can show up and hear from the judge. There's a lot of work that goes into it and kind of strategy about the timing of everything. So first, essentially, you know, very briefly, what is a pretrial conference? It's a time, a date assigned by the court for the parties and the attorneys to appear in front of the judge and outline the issues for the judge that remain contested. The judge wants to know what's the status, you know, what do you agree upon? What do you not agree upon? And with respect to the contested issues that are not agreed upon, you know, what's each side's position? Because the goal for the judge is to give some guidance on those issues to help you settle the case, because quite frankly, you know, they don't have the ability to try every single case that comes before them. So they want to try to help you guys to settle. And it's a very important, in my opinion, other than your trial, it's going to be one of the most important hearings you go to, because that guidance is valuable. You know, you get that guidance from the judge. The goal is you take that with you, continue negotiations, and then you are able to settle your case. So the hearing, like I said, is assigned by the court. You can't, you know, select your pretrial date. You'll get a notice in the mail with the hearing date. And the scheduling kind of depends on the particular county. Some counties are earlier than others. I can say that I very rarely have seen, if ever, a pretrial conference much before 6 months after the case has started with the filing and service. And, you know, some counties are later than that, more like 10 months after. So it kind of depends on your judge and their docket. So like I said, you'll get notice in the mail of the pretrial date. You need to review that notice very carefully, because it's a lot of important information. Not only, of course, it's going to have the date and time and location of your pretrial. Some judges will include discovery deadlines on that pretrial notice. So you got to pay attention to that. It also includes the requirement of the four-way meeting, which I'll talk about momentarily. And most, if not all, have this requirement that the four-way meeting occur if no less than 7 days before that pretrial conference. They don't want you, you know, meeting the day before, or, you know, meeting a half an hour before the hearing in the lobby of the courthouse. That's not what you should be doing. It's a meeting well in advance of the pretrial. So the aim of that is to be productive. And then the second page of most pretrial notices outlines all the information that you have to include in your memo. And we'll get to that later. So as I said earlier, there's a bit of a time period between the filing and service of the complaint and your eventual pretrial date. Now, you're not kind of just doing nothing and waiting to get that guidance from the judge. There's a lot of work you have to do to prepare for that pretrial. And most judges are going to hold you to that. If you show up at the pretrial without your work done, you know, I wouldn't want to be that attorney who does that. Judges would do not look favorably on that. So one of the things you have to do before that hearing is the four-way conference, and that the four-way meeting. And that's what I am going to talk about. That's my piece of today. So what is a four-way conference? A four-way conference is a meeting with the two attorneys, assuming there's two attorneys on the case and both parties, that you are required by the court to have prior to the pretrial conference. Like I said, you can't meet the day before or the morning of. It has to be at least 7 days in advance. And the purpose of that is for everyone to sit down and discuss the issues. Hopefully, by doing that, you'll be able to come to a full agreement. And then you use that time between the meeting and the pretrial to finalize a separation agreement, have the parties sign it, and you can use that pretrial date to have the parties get the parties divorced. It's not always possible, of course, to resolve it. Sometimes you do need the guidance from a judge at a pretrial conference, and that's fine. The four-way is still important because what you're doing then at the four-way meeting is narrowing the issues for the judge. So when you appear at the pretrial conference, you're focusing the judge's attention on the two or three issues that remain contested instead of every issue in the case, because you haven't taken the time to talk to opposing counsel to see if there actually is, you know, an agreement on those issues. So the timing of the four-way conference, in my opinion, is fairly important. As I said, you can't schedule too close to the pretrial conference, but you also don't want to schedule it too soon in your case, right? There are important things that should be completed before you sit down to really talk about settlement. So, you know, one of the obvious things that need to be done is you need to exchange financial statements, you know, so you have an understanding of the income, assets, expenses, et cetera, relevant to your case. If there is, for instance, a marital home that's not just being sold, you should have the appraisal done so you can talk about division of the assets. You know, you need to have the assets appraised and valued prior to talking about a division. If there are contested custody issues such that the court has appointed a guardian ad litem to do an investigation, I think it's important to have that investigation completed and the report reviewed by the parties prior to sitting down to talk about care and custody of the kids, because that's something that is important for them to understand what the GAL recommendations are. In my opinion, I think it's kind of like a balancing act when you decide when to have a pretrial, a four-way meeting. You don't want it too close to the pretrial, but then you need to have all of these things done in advance, discovery-wise, in order to have a productive meeting. So then another consideration beyond the timing of the four-way meeting is the location. During the pandemic, judges allowed, prior to the pandemic, it would have to be in person, no questions about it. During the pandemic, for obvious reasons, the judges allowed for four-way meetings by Zoom. And so now I think we're moving back into the idea where, you know, judges are wanting more in-person meetings and court appearances. So there is something to be said, I think, about having parties sit down in the same place and commit to, you know, I usually tell my clients, be there, plan to be there all day, make arrangements for the kids in the afternoon, because nothing's worse than finally making headway and then someone has to leave to go, you know, pick up the children from school. So if possible, plan to be there all day. And then as far as location goes, I mean, we're, you know, you're either going to be at Attorney A's office or Attorney B's office. I don't know about my colleagues, but I'm not a big stickler. I don't, you know, insist on having it in my office, especially because with, you know, an office in Boston, it's not unusual for people to say, I don't want to travel into Boston for the meeting. So you want to be practical. If everyone's down on the South Shore and you're the attorney on the North Shore in Boston, you're probably going to be traveling down to the South Shore for the meeting. And, you know, that's okay. There are pros and cons of having it at, you know, the other office as well. You know, I also think about kind of the logistics of it. Does the other attorney or which office has a more appropriate setup, a conference room available, preferably even two conference rooms, because sometimes you want to be able to split up the parties and kind of have the attorneys kind of talk to their clients privately and then talk to each other. So it's some very logistical decisions to make there. Another consideration with respect to the four-way meeting is prepping your client. I think sometimes we, as attorneys who do this all the time, we lose sight of the fact that unless your client has been through divorces in the past, this is their first time going through this, right? So they don't really know what to expect at a four-way conference. So, you know, I think explain to them exactly what it is and beforehand, kind of calm some nerves. They always ask, in my experience, am I going to have to talk? Always. So, you know, I let them know that it's informal. It's not like we're in front of a judge. I say that the attorneys will be doing most of the talking, because in my experience, the attorneys do. But, you know, sometimes you do, you know, have your client interject on something that they are more knowledgeable about, you know, the child's activity schedule or what time they get picked up from soccer practice, things like that. So, and I also think you have to know your client a little bit as far as how much prep they need. You know, some clients might just need an email kind of explaining to them. Other clients, you might want to schedule a little more time to kind of prepare them for the meeting, especially if your client and their soon-to-be ex-spouse, you know, haven't had any contact with each other. You know, this could be the first time they're sitting in the same room with each other for months and months, sometimes even years. So, you know, some parties are fine with each other. That doesn't stress them out at all to be in the same room talking with their ex-spouse, soon-to-be ex-spouse. Other parties, you know, get really, really nervous about that. So I think you have to kind of know your client and be able to kind of talk them through what the process is going to be. Another thing I like to consider doing in advance of the four-way meeting is, assuming I have all my ducks in a row, discovery-wise, appraisals done, et cetera, I like to draft up a separation agreement and send it out prior to meeting, if possible. It doesn't happen in every case, but I like to try to do this, because the way I look at it is, having that go out in advance, the other attorney has an opportunity to go through your preamble section to, you know, looking at the language that, you know, they might want to edit. And then also you can kind of drive the four-way meeting by your draft agreement. You know, they've already looked at it. Let's go through it. Do you agree on the alimony piece? Let's go to the parenting plan. Where don't we agree? So it's kind of an outline that I think is helpful to use for the four-way meeting. Sometimes it's even possible to get the other side's revisions back to your separation agreement before sitting down. And then you can really just focus your time in the meeting on those areas where there's disagreement. Kind of streamlines things a little bit, if possible. So now we get to the substance of the meeting. And, you know, every case is a little different. You know, there's no cookie cutter way to say this is how you should run a four-way meeting. I think that once you kind of get in the swing of things, you'll have your own style, your own way that you like to handle the meetings. In my case, usually I, you know, first thing I do is I, you know, thank the parties for coming and taking time out of their day and explain to them that we are here because it's required by the court and the purpose is to talk about your case and try to resolve it today. If not, that's okay. We'll narrow the issues. So then the judge will be able to speak on that, you know, in 2.5 weeks at the pretrial conference. And then as far as jumping into the issues, I personally like to start off with kind of the, I don't want to say easier issues, but the less hot button issues, I'll call it first, because I feel like there's some something to be said about having some momentum. So if we're ticking off, you know, health insurance, check, we have an agreement. Then we go to life insurance, we have an agreement. We agree on, you know, the dependency, you know, the child tax credit. So some of that, you know, starting with the quote unquote easier issues first in a case, and every case is different, obviously. I think parties sometimes feel encouraged to keep going and, wow, we're making a lot of progress today. This is great. And then you save the more, you know, contested issues for the end, because, you know, if things break down and you don't agree, well, that's okay, because you've already, you know, went through 75% of the issues you guys actually agree upon. And now we have the 25 that's going to be left for the judge to speak on. And that's fine. Another thing I think it's important to explain to your client ahead of time, and also reiterate when both parties are in earshot at the beginning of the meeting, is that The purpose of the meeting is to be productive. This isn't time for name calling or finger pointing or talking about, you know, why the marriage broke down and things like that. You know, that's a surefire way to lose focus, derail all the discussions. And, you know, it's not why we're there. I have had, you know, a few occasions, a meeting where, despite me saying a few times to the other side, you know, that's not what we're here for. You know, they're really just badgering my client, name calling, you know, just being nasty. And, you know, I think it's important to remember that, you know, you don't have to, you shouldn't, in my opinion, have your client sit there and have to take that for an hour or two, right? I usually remind the other side, I'm usually talking to my, you know, sister counsel or brother counsel and remind them that we're here to be productive. And, you know, we're going to have to suspend the meeting if their client continues to behave that way. And I have had to get up and might leave with my client on a few occasions because the other side just, you know, wouldn't relent. And I said earlier, there are a few pros about being at the other attorney's office, because it's a lot easier to get up and walk out when it's the other attorney's office than having to like kick them out of your office. That's a little awkward. So, you know, there are pros and cons as to the location of the meeting. Now, assuming that if you guys come to a full agreement, like I said, at that meeting, you use that time to get that separation agreement drafted, and, you know, and hopefully you have time to present it at the pretrial conference to get the parties divorced. If not, you know, that meeting is really an outline of what you're going to put in your pretrial memo to focus the judge's attention on. You know, we met on this date and this is what we agree upon and this is what we don't agree upon, because then the judge can really laser in and focus on those few issues you don't agree upon. So with that, I'm going to have Elisa talk about the pretrial memo next.
Thanks, Jen. So the pretrial memo is something that is also required to be filed with the court in advance of the pretrial conference. And part of the reason that the timing of having the four-way conference at least 7 days in advance of the pretrial conference is that most pretrial notice and orders require filing the pretrial memo at least 3 days in advance of your court hearing. Some judges have their own special pretrial notices and orders, so some don't require it to be filed until the day of or the morning or the day before. And there are definitely some attorneys that don't file it 3 days in advance, even though they're required to. But as starting out in this field, you should, you know, start it off by wanting to follow the rules. And there are also certain counties that they actually will take your court hearing off of their docket if they don't see that you filed the pretrial memos and required paperwork by the date you're required to. I had that happen to me once, and I will learn my lesson. So the pretrial memo itself has a certain number of sections that are requirements. The pretrial notice and order that you get from the court will list out what parts are supposed to be included in it. I have one in front of me, just the standard one. And that's a great guide to how to draft your pretrial memo. You can make section titles kind of consistent with how the pretrial notice and order lists it out, but it includes things like listing out the four-way conference details, the date, time, and place that you had the meeting. I will say that I am someone that definitely shifted to Zoom four-way conferences. And because I wrote Zoom in my pretrial memo, I got yelled at by a judge because he didn't want us to do it by Zoom. So I've learned my lesson with that too. But you know, they want to see that it happened at least the days in advance. If ever there was a situation in terms of scheduling as to why we couldn't do it at least 7 days in advance, I typically will explain that in the memo so that they don't get upset. Then you're supposed to include, I also list a section that just lists the counsel involved. So the court can see that listed clearly, but that's not a requirement. Then there's a section where you're supposed to list out kind of uncontested facts. You know, those are things like the date of the marriage, if they're children born of the marriage, their dates of birth, you know, addresses, if there's employment information that is relevant and you know, that's factual, so nobody can contest those things. I also tend to include a procedural history section. While you are having typically the same judge hear your case over the course of the case, it's helpful, I think, for a judge to see kind of where the case has gone thus far. Some cases are as simple as, you know, a divorce complaint was filed and the pretrial conference is the very first time that they're in front of a judge, but some cases have had motion hearings, temporary orders, different things like that happen. If I have a case that a motion has already been heard and filed, I actually will typically help do some of my work for me. And I've already listed out my uncontested facts or procedural history in a motion. So I'll typically copy and paste that from a motion and then just add in anything that's happened since that motion has occurred. And it's a good area to kind of set the scene for the court. You're supposed to continue the pretrial memo with a statement of contested issues of fact and progress towards agreement, if any. So if there is, after the four-way conference or kind of going over drafts of an agreement, issues that have tentatively been agreed upon, or, you know, there's already a partial agreement signed, I tend to list that out because I like the court to know that, you know, we did make some progress, or to be happy with us that we did make progress. So I tend to list those out just, you know, quick, like we agreed on legal custody or alimony waiver or life insurance or health insurance. And then there are some attorneys that simply just list like a bullet point of what the contested issues are, or they'll do it almost like a question. They'll pose it like a question, like whether or not mother or father should have primary physical custody of the kids or something. I tend to use the contested issues of law and section as like the meat of my pretrial memo. I will usually put a heading with the contested issue, the topic, and then kind of describe what my client's perspective is, and then maybe briefly touch on what I know the other side's perspective is, and you know, why we don't feel that that is correct. So it gives the court a chance to, if they're the type of judge that is going to read the pretrial memos in advance of when you're actually appearing in front of them, or if it's they're reading it before they call your case, then they can kind of go right to that section, see what the issues are and know what the perspectives are and be able to give that feedback to you. So the one slightly tricky thing is you're technically not supposed to share settlement discussions with a judge. And there's a very fine line between what is settlement discussions and kind of perspectives and positions. So, you know, it is a little tricky, but I usually will talk more in general about, you know, where the contested issue is, rather than say this side is proposing this really specific thing and we don't agree to that really specific thing. Then there is, a section for divorce cases, you're supposed to include stipulation of values and costs of different things that are actually, oh, sorry. I'm looking at mine, what order I put mine in, but the actual pretrial notice and order has it in a slightly different value, but section. But for divorce cases, you're supposed to put you're almost taking information from the party's respective financial statements and listing it there. Candidly, I don't really know why they make you do this, because they see your financial statements, but I think it helps the court just kind of see what the estate is. If there's real estate, if there's retirement assets at stake, cars, bank accounts, investment accounts, if there's any personal property of significance, things like that. So the court can kind of see if there's, you know, let's say one of the contested issues is real estate. If one person wants to keep the house, then the court may be able to say, oh, I think there's other assets with which you might be able to offset, as a feedback that they can give. It's supposed to be stipulated to values, meaning like there's agreement on it. If it's real estate and there hasn't been an appraisal done, then I'll typically just write estimated value or assessed value, or if there's competing appraisals, kind of write the two different ones. But other than that, and maybe the value of motor vehicles, you know, a retirement asset or a bank account, the balance is what the balance is. Then there's also in all divorce cases, you're supposed to include a section called the Section 34 factors. So Mass General Law Chapter 208, Section 34 is the governing law that helps a court decide how they would equitably divide a marital estate. There's a number of different factors that the court considers and how to do that. And this section of the pretrial memo is intended to kind of list out those factors so the court can kind of see what the situation of this family is. So it's things like how long the marriage is, if there's any issues of conduct of either party from during the marriage, ages, health of parties, their station in life, occupation, income sources, any, you know, special skills that they have, employability of the parties, any liabilities or needs that the parties have, the opportunity that each party has for, you know, acquiring assets and income in the future. If there are children in the marriage, what the needs are of the children, and contribution each of the parties made towards acquiring, preserving, and kind of increasing the value of their estate. And then also as homemaker of the family unit. So a lot of those factors are kind of statistical, factual information, like, you know, how long the marriage is, ages of the parties, occupation and sources of income. But this is actually the section of the pretrial memo where I almost always have to get specific input from my client to fill out in terms of conduct or, you know, vocational skills, unless somebody happens to have like a very easily accessible LinkedIn. I don't necessarily know, you know, their degrees and when they graduated from college. And then especially in the part that is discussing, you know, contributions towards the marital estate and the family unit. So the contributions for the family unit section, I'll usually ask my client, like, okay, who did the laundry, the cooking, the cleaning, the landscaping? Did you hire other people to do certain things for you? In terms of caretaking of the children, who got them ready for school in the morning? Who fed them dinner, helped them take a bath, who put them to sleep, who drove them to school, who picked them up from school, who scheduled the appointments, who, you know, signed them up for activities, and then kind of do just a little few sentence summary of those types of things. It is always interesting, I think, to see how different that paragraph of the different sides pretrial memos are when you compare the one you get from opposing counsel. Then there's also a requirement of a section about discovery and the status of discovery. Court judges typically do not want to give a trial date out to parties and counsel if there is ongoing discovery going on. So if, you know, you write that, you know, we're all set, we've done our Rule 410 disclosures and, you know, minimal discovery, we have everything we need, they're going to say, okay, these people have really tried here and maybe are actually ready for a trial. Whereas if, you know, someone writes a paragraph that says, I have a motion to compel pending and we need to do depositions and we need to do that, you're probably going to have a judge say, okay, how much more time do you need to finish discovery before I actually, you know, give you a trial date? Witnesses section that you have to list out is kind of, if you're now shifting gears towards saying, okay, if this judge is actually going to give me a trial, realistically, who would I want to be a witness? You will find that some people list out 30 witnesses, when in reality, a trial is going to have maybe 5. But it helps give the court a sense of how long of a trial that this might need to be, depending on the witnesses that either party is considering doing. It's always important to list both parties as witnesses because you might get into a situation where if you don't list the other side as a witness and then their attorney chooses to not put them on their own list, then that person's testimony will not be heard by the court. I also tend to list, even though you would hope that in the process of preparing for a trial, you guys can reach agreements on exhibits for, like, you know, bank records or things like that. Listing keeper of records for bank institutions, you know, if it's records for child, if it's school records, medical records, things like that. Also, you have to list if you want an appraiser, or, you know, a business valuator or kind of professionals, or even experts. I also typically list like a kind of standard line of, you know, might also call a rebuttal witness and reserving the right to supplement the list, you know, prior to any trial. And then there's a section for exhibits that you wouldn't intend to offer at trial. So I tend, for that section, I kind of think about, you know, financial statements, tax returns, bank statements, if there's any appraisals done, credit card statements, things of that nature. There's going to be unique circumstances to each and every case, depending on what the issues are. You know, a lot of the ones related to custody, there doesn't tend to be so much volume of documents as that is tends to be more about testimony. But, if custody is an issue, there might be communications between the parties as the types of exhibits or records related to the children. I think exhibits a lot more end up being, you know, related to financial issues, tends to be. And then I also do kind of a standard, like other exhibits as maybe necessary and reserving the right to supplement that. The witness and exhibit, well, sorry, I guess more the witness list section of it, I think is really important to be fully fleshed out in your pretrial memo. Because I have had as recently as last month, a judge at the pretrial conference say, okay, I'm going to give you a trial date. Who are your witnesses? And, you know, wide-eyed and, you know, shocked that was going to happen, I quickly turned to my pretrial memo and was able to kind of whisper to my client, okay, if we're going to pick, you know, 5 of these people, who would they be, and decide that. Whereas if that wasn't listed out in a pretrial memo, clearly that could have been disastrous. And then at the end of it, you're supposed to list your estimate of trial time, how much time you realistically think you need to try the issues that are remaining contested in consideration of how many witnesses there might be and the types of testimony that they, you know, how long their testimony is going to be and the exhibits that need to be presented. I will say that sometimes I think it might be tactical for people to limit how much they think trial time would be because they want to get a trial date sooner rather than later. And so they want to make the judge think that they can get it done really quickly. But then on the other end, it is also tactical sometimes. Like, let's say someone's happy with the status quo of things and they don't want a trial to come because they're happy with the status quo. And the longer the status quo is in place, it might help them. They might suggest that a trial might take multiple days so that the court sees that and thinks, oh no, I can't fit this in. I can't squeeze this in on a, you know, a random afternoon here and there. They're not going to get a trial for a year. So there's a little bit of strategy there. And then at the end, if, you know, if there's financial issue at play, and child, well, every case will have financial issue at play, or you're required to submit a financial statement for pretrial conferences. And then if there's children and support at issue, you're supposed to submit a child support guidelines worksheet. In terms of drafting, kind of overall general tips, I think if courts see a really, really long pretrial memo, they might get worried about that. There's also some judges that have limits on the number of pages that you can, I think it's 10 pages is the limit. I sometimes fiddle with, you know, spacing or margins to fit that in. It's hard because there's a lot of things that are required to be in there. And, you know, let's say you're listing out exhibits and that takes up almost a whole page, then that kind of hurts you. Also, just the pretrial memo has to be served on the other side to consider that as well. So, you know, I think being concise as possible and as informative as possible. Some judges really, really take the pretrial memos seriously and really read through it. Other judges kind of skim it. Other judges don't even look at it until you're in front of them. But, you know, if there's ever going to be a chance that a judge goes back and looks at it more detailed, it could also be something that is strategically used against you in, you know, future hearings. Like, I've caught certain things, statements that are inaccurate, and I have documentation to back up that it is inaccurate. So when, you know, the premise behind a position that someone has as listed in their pretrial memo is inaccurate, you know, you can point that out at the pretrial conference or to the other side. I think it also sometimes helps seeing someone's position listed out, that maybe your four-way conference, you didn't get so far in it, or, you know, emotions got in the way of things, but then seeing in a pretrial memo that this is actually their position on that. In fact, I've had situations where I didn't realize that was the position. And when I saw it listed in a pretrial memo, I was able to reach out and say, oh, I think that's not contested then as well. On the other hand, sometimes you think an issue is resolved and then you read for the first time ever that it is not resolved in a pretrial memo. So having that in advance of hearing helps you to kind of scramble and prepare for, you know, your point on that. And yeah, making sure you file that timely so you don't get in trouble with the court or miss out on your hearing. I think at this point, all divorce cases are supposed to be able to have e-filing done, but I always print, and you know, if you send it to opposing counsel before, I always print off 3 copies of it, if not 4, for the actual pretrial day, just if it didn't make its way into the physical file, and to, you know, give a copy to opposing counsel and then my own so I can have it in front of me at the hearing and then also to take notes on it if needed. I think that's it. Katie, you want to take it away on the actual pretrial conference itself?
Sure. Thank you. So I guess the first thing I will say is what to bring with you to the pretrial. So this is you know, the night before, got to make sure I have everything ready to go. The first thing's obviously the memo, which Elisa just touched upon, did a great job there. Updated financial statement, which she also mentioned. Child support guideline, if there's child support issue, and a deviation worksheet, if there's any sort of deviation involved. Those are sort of baseline. Some judges like proposed judgments as well. There are some judges that will not call your case if there's no proposed judgment. They want it. And lately I've sort of been erring on the side of caution. And, you know, for example, I had a case back in February, didn't know if the judge wanted a proposed judgment, never been in front of him before. And I was like, you know what, I'm going to at least do it, because if we can get some feedback on it, I can turn this into a separation agreement. I can make it easy for myself. So I did do one. And then I think it also, the other attorney then I think saw that I did one and she did one. So it was actually really helpful to see her position laid out, because I didn't really understand like what the guy wanted. And then, so then I did. So proposed judgment, I think is key. It also really helps you sort of focus on exactly what you want to ask for. And maybe you even do it before you do the pretrial memo. Okay, this is what I'm ultimately want. Now, how do I explain how I want to get there? So I also, you know, yes, like Elisa said, e-filing, but bring copies. Assume they don't have it. Assume it wasn't accepted. Assume it didn't make it into the file. I always bring 3 or 4 copies. 4 is, you know, back in the day, I used to always bring 4. It'd be, you know, 1 for me, 1 for the court, 1 for opposing counsel, 1 for my client. You know, a lot of clients now just want stuff electronically, but 4 is a good number. That way you have them. So sometimes it is too many. I do a lot of recycling, but it's important to make sure you have enough copies.
Same way that we single-handedly keep trees dying every year.
That's right. It's true. It's true. So I would bring those things, you know, with you. Also, I would bring past financial statements, especially if you get one, you know, hopefully it's 3 days in advance. Also with the memo, you should be filing your financial statement. And you get the other side's financial and you look at the financial statement that they did 3 months prior and you're like, is this the same person? Everything's are different. So you want to make sure you bring prior financials so you can alert the judge to any craziness that may be going on the financial, some inflated expenses, big changes in income, anything like that. Bring, you know, a copy of the complaint, basically your whole pleadings index, which most of us have pleadings indexes. Indices. But if you also want to have separate, you know, make sure you have your interrogatories at the ready. So if they say something in the courtroom, the other side says something, and you have an interrogatory that they've signed under the pains and penalties of perjury that's different, you'll be able to point that out very quickly to the judge. So having all of that stuff sort of with you is really important. So those are the things to bring with you. Also bring a calculator, because you never know. The next thing I sort of want to address is the presentation at the pretrial itself. So, and I can't really tell you, you know, how to do your pretrial, because all facts and issues and cases are different, but what I can talk about is how you should behave in the court. So, you know, you really need to decide if this is the beginning of your career, what kind of lawyer do you want to be in the court? I think that's really important. And I would say, almost every judge, I would say, does not like a lawyer to go nuclear right out of the gate. So that if you're loud, you know, sometimes if you're speaking very quickly, like you're just so afraid someone's going to interrupt you, and so you're talking, that's not good either. So it's easier to get your point across and people listen better when you're clear, concise, and calm. So, and even better if the other side. So you've given your presentation, you're clear, concise, calm. These are the issues, Your Honor. These are our positions. Really hope that you give us some feedback. If the other side goes nuclear, it actually looks great for you, because you look like the voice of reason. The judge might think, well, I think I know what's going on in this case. This person is, you know, completely unreasonable. What is happening here? So you definitely, that's a good place to be with the judge. Don't interrupt the other lawyer. Interruption is the rudest form of communication. And it happens all the time. I mean, I think people have gotten better about it, but sometimes it's egregious. And if the judge, most judges will say something, they'll say, counsel, you had your turn. Like, we'll get back to you. But if it continues to happen and the judge isn't saying something, you know, I would say something like, Your Honor, can I please finish? You know, my brother and my sister has had the opportunity to make their presentation, and I would simply like the same opportunity for my client so you can hear his or her position. Very calm. Again, juxtaposition to nuclear on the other side is keeping it calm. And judges do respond to that well. They really do. So I think that's a really important piece of that. So at the pretrial, you know, you go first, you're the plaintiff, right? So you, and I'll deal with both sides. So you're the plaintiff, you go first. And as Elisa said, sometimes in your memo, you will have slightly addressed what you think their issues are going to be to get ahead of them. So if you're the plaintiff, you give your position and you know, exactly why you think things should be as they should be for your client, and perhaps touch on, you know, I know that you're going to hear from my sister, blah, blah, blah. This is why that position's inaccurate or incorrect or not in the child's best interest or not equitable, whatever it might be. If you're the defendant and you get to go second, it's always about thinking on your feet too, because you may have had a whole presentation prepped and you're the defendant, and then plaintiff has just said something and you're like, I have to say something. I have to address this piece very quickly so I can move on to mine. So you could start by saying, Your Honor, I heard my sister counsel say X. That's not true. You know, let me just briefly explain that to you before I get into my client's position, just so that you don't forget the thought. So, you know, it's usually the defendant that's going to have to kind of make that play, that call, sort of mid-pretrial. And then sometimes if you're the plaintiff, you want a chance to briefly respond. You also need to gauge the judge. So I've been in pretrials where I've been the plaintiff, give my presentation, the other side goes, the position is, it's wacky and it's not what the law says. And at first, you know, I was going to respond. I was going to ask to respond, but the judge started talking and he was completely on my side. And I said, well, I'm done. I'm not going to talk anymore. I can't do anything better than what he's saying. So I'm just going to shut up. So, it's sometimes good to know when to just shut up. And you'll know, you will know. So post pretrial. So, you know, let me back up. One of the things I like to say to judges, if you truly mean it, if you think, you know, Your Honor, we've got some issues. We do think that if we get some feedback from you, we might be able to settle this case. Ask them for feedback. Plead with them for feedback. Some judges give excellent feedback at pretrials and some do not. So if you ask, these are the couple of issues we really want to hear from you, please. You know, and that's to let the judge know, okay, maybe I can help these people resolve this case and I won't have to see them again, but for a quick 5-minute colloquy on a separation agreement. So don't be afraid to say that. So then after the pretrial, well, sometimes mid-pretrial. So for example, the case I was talking about earlier, you know, when I brought the proposed judgment, the judge gave good feedback. And he said, you know, is it worth you people going out in the hall and having a conversation and then seeing where we go from there? And, you know, always say yes, always say yes. If you say no, the judge is going to wonder, again, what's wrong with you? Like, don't you want to resolve this case? And then they're not going to forget it because their memories are sometimes impeccable. So I would say, absolutely, Your Honor, we'd love a second call or whatever after we have a discussion. So the other attorney and I went in the hallway, maybe an hour or so, hashing things back and forth. We ended up finally coming to terms on the issues that were outstanding. We didn't have a working separation agreement at that time, but we did, you know, we were able to come to an agreement. So we went back in, talked to the clerk. She went and talked to the judge and she said, we'll give you a second pretrial date. And if you get a separation agreement done before then, e-file it, email me, let me know. We'll give you a Zoom and you can quickly get them divorced. So so I did. I wrote a separation agreement. And we're kind of going back and forth on it. So, you know, that was critical, was just hearing from the judge. So I think a couple of points on that talking in the hallway. Unless there's a circulated separation agreement that's been going back and forth, I would not advise you to have your client sign something in the hallway unless they had seen it many times prior. If this is the first time, like opposing counsel hands you a separation agreement that morning, I would not let my client sign that. I don't draft on demand. I don't force my client to sign on demand. I want to have a conversation about what everything means. Don't draft on demand, don't sign on demand ever. You know, there will be times where you have a full agreement, but for a couple of issues, which has happened before to me, like we literally had two blanks in our separation agreement. And we told the judge we were in agreement on every single thing except for these two discrete issues. Can we get your feedback? And we literally went out and hand wrote in the two blanks that we had. That I recommend doing. But you know, too much handwriting on an agreement to me means there may not have been enough thought put into it. And perhaps your client, we do not want buyer's remorse. That is the last thing you want as a lawyer. Client signs off, they get divorced, you go home, yay. The next day they call you and say, you know, I didn't really understand what was going to happen with that bank account. Or like, oh, I thought I was going to have Sunday overnights. That's a nightmare. That is a nightmare. So I don't recommend it doing that. So a couple of pro tips, which I'm sure most of you probably already figured out, get there early. The sooner you're in, typically the sooner you're out. Because if you check in soon, everybody's there, you've got all your memos, your financial statements, everything in place, you will get your case called. It's important. And, you know, it's also not only respectful of the court, but the other lawyer's time. And I've certainly been there on time before and the other lawyer rolls up at, you know, 9:30. And I'm like, where have you been? The hearing's at 8:30, you know? Plus I think also it behooves you to get there early because what if you could have a conversation ahead of time again? Like you had your four-way, you guys did your memos, maybe you want to talk again. So get there early so you can give yourself enough time to do that if you want to, or you want to prep your client in the hallway a little bit more and have a little bit more discussion because maybe you just got the pretrial memo. You need time to read it. You need time to talk about it. That's happened to me. I've been handed I filed mine 3 days in advance as I'm required to. Other attorney hands it to me or she emailed me like, you know, the night before at like 7:45, which I didn't see. So she gave it to me the next day and there's stuff in there that I'm like, what is this? So I'm glad I was there early so I could talk to my client and be like, is this true? And she's like, no, let me explain it to you. So, you know, the sooner you're there, the better for a number of reasons. But that would be my recommendation. So, you know, I don't really have anything else to say with regard to the pretrial itself and sort of post-pretrial, but if either of you have anything else to add, feel free to jump in. But that's my spiel on be respectful, don't go nuclear, and come prepared.
I was going to say, I always bring my laptop to court actually these days. Because if you do have a working draft of a separation agreement, and maybe it's not as easy as two blanks, but there's a few provisions that you have kind of two options for language, then, you know, you can go to make the changes and the clerks are almost always willing to print off one copy for you if you email it to them.
I'm glad you mentioned that. I have done that a few times where we're just trying to hammer out a couple of things. And if you're in Lowell, it's a little tip for the people that signed up today because you're here. So in the Lowell courthouse, downstairs, it's the library, but they will print a certain number of pages for you for free. After that, they're going to make you pay, I believe. But I've been down there before with my USB and I'm like, I just need to print this so they can sign it. They were wonderful. They took me to the computer. They printed it out for me. And I got some people divorced. That it was excellent. So it's a little pro tip. First floor, Lowell.
There you go. Yeah. And I think too, it's a balancing act of, like you said, Katie, like you don't want your client to ever feel like, I felt really rushed. This was a lot. I just heard from the judge, especially if the guidance isn't really what your client wanted to hear, right? Sometimes they just need time to digest it too. So I think it's your job to kind of not get pressure, whether from the judge or from the other side, to go out the hallway, write up something when your client's not ready for that, right? You know your client. And I think that is something that it's a little uncomfortable when you're starting off in your career to, you know, tell a judge, no, we can't resolve this today. We're making good progress, but we need another date, judge. But that's your job. And I think you have to. I think you can't really feel the pressure because the other side might love that guidance. Yes, let's go sign it in the hallway right now. And I think you really have to kind of, you know, advocate for your client in that respect too, not to, you know, make them feel like, you know, calling Katie the next day with the buyer's remorse.
Yeah.
So I think that's important too. So
yeah, I forgot to say something when talking about the pre-trial memo that I know the three of us had talked about before, which is those situations where you actually are very, very close to settlement and have a separation agreement, like, you know, 95% of it done, then in terms of like kind of like saving your client legal expenses, drafting a whole detailed pre-trial memo, it's, you know, a few hours of work, I'd say. And it almost seems not necessary, but for the fact that you have to file one. So in situations like that, I've done really, really bare bones ones, where I kind of am like, I'm not really going to detail the Section 34 factors, but I will if needed, you know, discovery's done or something like that. And so you kind of make sure that you get it filed for the sake of the requirement, but you're not, you know, incurring lots of legal fees for your client when you know it's a situation you're just going to go get feedback on one or two things and then hopefully be able to wrap it up.
Yeah. There was a time Lisa and I talked about this. I literally did like one line and I wrote in the memo, cause I was concerned about not filing it. I wrote something like, a separation agreement has been circulated. It was like three lines. And it was funny because I filed it and I sent it to the other attorney. And she said for 2 seconds, like, what? How could she file a pretrial memo? And she goes, oh, then I opened it. Was like, oh, okay. Yeah. That makes sense. She thought I did like a full memo.
Sometimes I've even, when you're really close, and I think, you know, if you do a proper pretrial memo for litigation, it's probably going to blow up the case you don't want to blow up, right? So yeah. Sometimes when you're really close, I've talked to my, you know, other attorney and said, you know, why don't we do the same idea, bare bone ones, let's do a joint. Mm-hmm. So then it's really bare bones, we're fulfilling their requirement, you know, and you know, some judges like that, some judges don't, but you know, I think also you're teetering between, if I say what I need to say in an actual pretrial memo, we're taking 12 steps back in this case, and you don't want to do that either. So I think you're kind of walking a fine line in between fulfilling a requirement and moving the case forward, you know, as your client wants you to. So
yeah, I would take the heat from a judge being miffed about a joint memo over blowing up your case. Like I would take the heat. It's like, I can't believe you filed a joint memo. Well, Your Honor, and as long as you and the other attorney are on the same page, we're so close. We don't want to, you know, risk, you know, blowing up this case and filing memos that'll just create problems. And usually they'll be like, okay, fine. Right. I agree.
I think you can do it once in a case with most judges. You can't do it a second time around. The next pretrial, if you haven't settled, I think you need to do the real pretrial memo. They're not going to do it two times.
Agreed. Yeah. So I don't see any questions in the Q&A.
Don't either.
So I'm going to assume we don't have any questions unless anybody wants to type one really quickly. We're happy to answer them.
The BBA is Boston's largest legal network built on justice, community, education, and inclusion. Take advantage of our exclusive Express membership offer and save 50% off BBA membership through August 31st, 2024. Enjoy the full benefits of BBA membership and take advantage of BBA programs and events, discounts on services, access to the full Learn Online library, and much more. This special offer is only available through March 15, 2024. Use code EXPRESS50 at checkout.